Thanks, Paul, for asking the questions and then getting me to do the answering. Yeah, good. I'll just... Sure. And I love that question from Ben, like, I'm vanilla, how do I reach these people when I'm not a hipster? Well, I go to a Chinese church. I've been going to the same Chinese church in Sydney for over 30 years. And I said to my pastor, you know, I go to these church plants and it's full of these hipster people. They're all so good looking. They're outliers. They look like they've come off some catalogue from Oxford Shop or something. And I said, and I look at my church and we're the opposite end of the spectrum. We're nerds. We're uncool. We're geeks. And I said, we are the church for the nerds and the geeks, where the people who don't fit in come in and they feel like, oh, finally there's a church for me because I'm not good looking. I'm not well dressed. And so that's our church. That's how we're contextualized. We're the church where the geeks can feel at home. Now, where'd that pen go? Fantastic. All right, so let's begin with this. I'm going to draw. This is Jane. Jane is a 16-year-old Australian-born Chinese. You know, mum's a lawyer, dad's a surgeon, and she's 16 and she's studying high school, and her ambition in life is to study hard, get into university, be a doctor, be a lawyer. And then she wanders into your church. She wanders into your youth group. And so what do you say to her? You're probably going to say to something like, Jane, there's more to life than study. There's more to life than university. There's more to life than good marks. There's more to life than medicine. You need Jesus. If you want to be serious about Jesus, you might even think about giving up medicine and becoming a missionary or going to a full-time ministry. There's more to life than study, Jane. And then while you're in that same church, one day wanders in That's right. Jack. Jack is 16 and he's a surfy. He's from the coastal beach culture and he wanders into your church and he says he wants to get serious about Jesus and his ambition in life is to drop out of school at 16, no need to finish high school, get into a trade and so he can surf all day, each and every day, you know, leave work early around 3, surf. That's his ambition in life. And you say, Jack, you know, there's more to life than surfing. In fact, if you want to get serious about Jesus, you might want to use some of the gifts that God has given you. Apply yourself, study hard, maybe go to university, maybe even get in a profession, because that way, you know, you could use your profession to support ministry. Now, what have you done? Have you given Jane Jesus? Have you given Jack Jesus? No, you've asked Jane to become Jack, and you've actually asked Jack to become Jane. You haven't given them Jesus. What you've done is you've given them your culture. You've imposed upon them your culture, and you've made your culture Jesus. Now, we laugh at old missionaries who made Africans sing hymns on organs because we think, oh, you know, they've just imposed their Western culture upon them. They haven't given them Jesus. I used to work in a Bible college where my principal said, oh, you know, these Chinese churches are funny. When you go there, you have to wear a suit and tie. You know, and I said to him, who do you think made the Chinese wear a suit and tie in the first place? It was you guys, probably a Presbyterian. You know. So again, we laugh at these people and impose their culture upon other people, but we do the same. When we tell Jane there's more to life than study, we tell Jack there's more to life than surfing, you need to be serious. We're actually asking, we're imposing upon them our culture. And so how can Jack follow Jesus and still be a surfy Christian? How can Jane follow Jesus and still be an Asian Australian? To do that, we need contextualization. And that's what we're going to do in our 3 sessions together. In this first session, we're going to look at, well, are we allowed to contextualize? Are we allowed to do that? In the next session, we're going to look at, well, how can I interpret culture so that I can connect my gospel with that culture? And in our 3rd and final session, we'll look at how we can move from culture to the gospel. All right, so this first session now is part 1. So let's go to, you see there's an outline there. So after we've done Jane versus Jack, Our next heading is, are we allowed to contextualize? And we'll look at the definition of contextualization. And I'm just reading this back to you. It's speaking the gospel to a culture in a way that is meaningful to that culture. And here I've got several things to say. Number one, well, what is the aim of contextualization? The aim of contextualization is three things. One, to communicate the message of the gospel. Two, in a way faithful to God's revelation. But three, in a way that's meaningful to the hearers in their own cultural and existential context. One of my missions lecturers called Richard Hibbert used to say, what you say is not what they hear. We have to reorganize our information. And one way of putting that is this. There's a difference between being sender orientated versus receptor orientated. So what we have crystal clear in our head is not what they're hearing on the receptor end. Interestingly, my kids go to swimming lessons, and every new term, they put them with new teachers in a new time in a new lane. So I turn up there, and how do you think I want the information on the board organized? You know, I'm looking for my kid's name, so I'm going to work out who's the new teacher, what's a new time, what's a new lane. I want my kid's name, don't I? They should have the names of the kids, alphabetical order. But it always comes with the names of the instructors. And then I look for the instructor and say, is my kid there? No. Is my kid there? No. Is my kid there? Then finally find the instructor with your kid's name in, and from there you work out the lane and the time. Can you see what they've done? It's been sender-orientated. It's how they would want the information organized under the names of the instructors. But I want it receptor-orientated. And church websites are the same, and any website is the same. It's always in sender language. Like, this is how the church looks like in our heads, you know, under this organization there. When really what they want to do is just, where are you? Like, where are you? You know, what time would this meeting be? But we've got, you know, vision statement, mission statement, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, that's a quick thing. So why do we do this? We're still in point one. All ministry is contextualization. I'm preaching to the converted. That's why you're here. All preaching is contextualization. All evangelism is contextualization. Interestingly, I used to teach at a Bible college where they said, you can teach this contextualization stuff in evangelism. You can teach this stuff in your missions lectures, but don't teach it in preaching. I thought, wow, isn't it amazing? Because for them, like, there's culture, because it's a non-Christian culture in evangelism. There's culture in missions because you're speaking to non-white people. But when you're preaching, there's no culture. You know, this whole idea that we are neutral culture, it doesn't exist. But all of ministry is contextualization. All right, well, number two, can you put it another way? Well, Mark Driscoll once put it this way. In contextualization, we're demonstrating the relevancy of gospel to a culture. We're not selling out and making the gospel relevant. We're just showing a culture how the gospel is relevant to their questions. Or Timothy Keller puts it this way, contextualization is not giving them the answers they want to hear, that's selling out, but it's giving them God's answers, which they may not want to hear, but to the questions that they are really asking. Or Timothy Keller puts it another way, it's to enter and challenge. So we're doing this double thing of entering and challenging. So under the enter heading, don't use non-essentials of the gospel that will unnecessarily offend or confuse them. Don't make them do things they don't have to do. That's legalism, over the page. And don't make them give up things they don't have to give up. Again, that's legalism. And we also have to challenge. So don't remove essentials of the gospel that will necessarily offend. Challenge, we have to make them do what they have to do and make them give up what they have to give up. So notice there's a tension there. So the tension there is this. We're trying to look for this sweet spot right in the middle where we have entered and we have challenged. We might, the dangers, we might over-adapt. And is that what I've done? Yep, we've over-adapted. We might over-adapt. And the opposite danger is we might under-adapt. Often in ministry we said, oh, this contextualization stuff is dangerous because there's this risk we over-adapt and we sell out just best to keep doing what we're doing. No, if we keep doing what we're doing, we've got the opposite danger, which is just as not ideal, which is to under-adapt. What happens when we under-adapt is we haven't entered at all. So you haven't even challenged because you haven't entered at all. And you'd be unnecessarily offensive, which is what I mentioned earlier. And they can't understand you because you're speaking your language form. So you're being sender-oriented rather than receptor-oriented. And you're actually giving them legalism because you're asking them to do what they don't have to do and give up what they don't have to give up. And actually it's a form of colonialism. You're giving them your culture, not the gospel. So that's the problem with under-adapting. But over-adapting, which is the one we're usually worried about, is we've entered but we haven't challenged them. And we're never offensive, which is what Deborah was talking about. Hey, we're just happy Christians. We're never offensive. They don't realize, you know, we've got a message that will challenge them. And this is what missionaries call syncretism, where they can just adopt our beliefs to their beliefs and just add it without having to give anything up. So that's what happens when you over-adapt. But right in the middle is this happy little sweet spot where you enter and challenge. So you're necessarily offensive and they understand you. And this is what we call that sweet spot of contextualization. Or more technically, we call it critical. Critical contextualization. Some people call this one uncritical contextualization. So we're looking for that sweet spot right in the middle. Then we can go to point three, but you might still be saying, why can't I just give them the gospel? Why can't I just give them the gospel? Well, because if we don't, we're under-adapting, is the short answer. But other things to say is we can't avoid contextualization. This whole idea is of there's no such thing as culture. No, we can't avoid contextualization. I remember Mark Driscoll putting it this way. Look at what we're doing right now. We're meeting indoors. That's quite contextualized, isn't it? Because in some cultures, we'll be meeting outdoors and we're sitting down around tables. That's what we do in our cultures. In other cultures, we'll be standing up. And we've got men and women together, whereas in some cultures, you'd have the men and the women separate. And we're speaking English and we're speaking modern contemporary English and we've decided to stress smart casual. So you can't avoid culture. Like I could have come here in a suit and tie and that would have been unnecessarily offensive. So we're always having to contextualize. We can't avoid it. I'll just be quick. And then if we don't do it, we have all these risks. We're actually giving them legalism and colonialism. So why can't I just give them the gospel? Well, we can't avoid culture. We're always in culture. Which brings me to point four then. Okay, good. Point four, there is no universal decontextualized form of the gospel. I'm getting this from Keller. So again, this is whole idea, why can't I just give them the gospel? Well, the answer is there is no universal decontextualized form of the gospel. The instant we present the gospel, we have chosen to be contextual, historical, and particular. So people point out Jesus did this when he chose to be a man and not a woman. And we don't want to get into the theology of could he have been a woman. He chose first century, so that's a particular time and location. Palestinian, he spoke Aramaic, he spoke Greek. So he became contextual, historical, and particular. And we do this as well. So again, I'm speaking English. I'm not speaking German right now. I'm speaking contemporary English, not Shakespeare English. We do this when we work out what illustrations to use, what music to use, what questions to answer. Like Jane's questions will be different from Jack's questions earlier on. So again, we're always doing it, we're always doing it, we're always doing it. And Timothy Keller says, don't be dogmatic about our ways in. We might have found a way that works really well, but that was for our culture. There'll be things that don't work well in other cultures. So often we have this McDonald's franchise idea of Christian ministry, you know, where, boy, this worked really well in Sydney. it will work well in Perth. This will work well in Singapore. No, 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 no. It worked really well in your context. And actually, this is the irony. What makes it work well in your context means it probably won't work so well in some other context. And so don't be dogmatic about the way we do it. I remember one missiologist telling me, you know, the Americans use four spiritual laws. Is anyone familiar with four spiritual laws? And so these missionaries from America are always using four spiritual laws because that worked really well in a university campus in America in the 1960s, right? But he said they're trying to use it in Africa. And I said, oh, it so doesn't work. And so he said, just to show you what it feels like, I'll show you the track that they use in Africa. And it was some poster with some hideous, grotesque painting on it. He said, yeah, this works really well in Africa. Could you imagine this working well in Sydney? And he said, no, well, that's the point. That's the point. That's contextualization. Whatever makes it work well in one context usually means it's not going to work so well in some other context. All right, going over the page then. I'm just laying down the groundwork here. Then next point, number five. It should be five. You got six there. Every form of gospel presentation will over and under adapt. And I'm getting this from Keller. Because we're so blinded by our culture, we cannot see our cultural blind spots. As a result, every gospel presentation will have some form of over and under adaptation. What does that mean? Well, in every culture, you're always treading this line between being too individualistic or too tribal or too collective. Maybe too much on hierarchy or too much on equality. So you're always treading this line, trying to look for that sweet spot right in the middle. But you always be sometimes over-adapting or sometimes under-adapting. And Timothy Keller uses this example. Let's say we're on the spectrum of individualism. Versus collective. Where on this spectrum does the gospel want us to be? This here, this here, or this out here? So right now in the West, we're pretty individualistic, aren't we? Where you get to choose your version of milk, you get to choose your version of coffee. Do you want one sugar, two sugars? So it's very individualistic. You get to download your music, you listen to it by yourself in your headphones, you get your own room, you study by yourself. So it's a very individualistic culture. Sometimes you might be thinking, is it too individualistic? Is the Bible telling us we need to be more collective? Do you think what the Bible's wanting us? Like the Bible saw us here right now eating our own bread, drinking our own coffee, listening to our own music. Would the Bible say you need to be more group orientated? Is that what the Bible's trying to tell us to be? Is the Bible telling us we should be more like the Amish? So here's right now us in Perth. Should we be like the Amish? Because the Amish are a lot more collective. You know, you share your possessions. You probably share your music. You listen to each other's music. You probably get the bread that they bake for you, that they've harvested. You don't get to choose your version of bread. We would build the church building together. You don't get to choose whether you want the morning traditional service, the family service, or the evening contemporary service. No, there's just one service. Is this where the Bible wants us to be? More collective. This is more the New Testament community. Is this where we should be? Well, Timothy Keller says, well, what about the Orca Indians? They would be looking at the Amish and go, boy, you guys are individualistic because you got wars. We have no wars. And so when you eat, poo and have sex, everyone knows what you're doing. And they talk about the American missionaries when they go live with the Orca Indians. They say, you can't even shower in private because you've got to go to the local river. And everyone goes, hey, the white woman's having a bath. And everyone comes over and they watch you having a bath. And when your mail comes, it's been opened and been read 20 times before it comes to you. This is collective. There's no room for individualism. Is this where the New Testament wants us? Because these guys, we're looking at the Amish and go, whoa, you guys are so individualistic. And whereas the Amish looking, you guys in Perth go, boy, you guys are so individualistic. Where does the Bible want us? Do you know what I mean? See, there's no easy answer. And it means no matter where you are, someone's going to accuse you of under-adapting and someone's going to accuse you of over-adapting. So don't be dogmatic thinking, we have got it right. No, there will always be someone on one end and the other end of the spectrum looking at you. You guys are sold out. Hey, you guys need to do a bit more work in contextualization. And so he gives the example of a friend he knows who is a minister. He said, oh, you know, I don't like the way we have three services. We have the 8 a.m. traditional, 10 a.m. family, 5 p.m. contemporary. I think the New Testament wants us to have just one big service. And everyone in his church is like, don't do it. Don't do it. Right now it's working really well. Don't do it. He goes, no, we're too individualistic. Let's merge them all together. And they said, don't do it. But he still did it, and boom, it split the church. And they just lost everything, lost everyone. And Timothy Keller says, why would you do that? Why would you merge all your services when everyone's saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't? Because somehow you are convinced you've got the biblical way and everyone else is wrong. And so what Timothy Keller says, just be a bit more humble in what we're doing. And be a bit more humble about saying, we've got the biblical way, because there's always going to be someone say, no, you've under-adapted, no, you've over-adapted. So be humble, because we'll always be over and under-adapting in some way, whether we know it or not, and always keep looking for that sweet spot. And to do that, we need to understand what we call cultural hermeneutics. We all know how to do Bible hermeneutics, interpret the Bible, but we need cultural hermeneutics where we interpret culture. So let's come to the conclusion, bottom of that chapter, of this little section. To think that all we have to do is give them the Bible is a little bit too simplistic at best, naive at worst. For we ourselves have to understand and apply the Bible, we also need to be experts in cultural hermeneutics. So let's go over the page now. What is culture? What does God think of culture? Or more nerdy way of putting it, what is a theology of culture? What does God himself think of our culture or culture in general? Well, number one, there is a divine aspect. There's a godliness aspect in all cultures. Why? Because of A, the incarnation. At the incarnation, Jesus the Word became flesh. Now think of what's happening here. Jesus is the Word, the second person of the Trinity, eternal, above culture, true for all times, all peoples, all places, no culture. Okay, the second person of the Trinity, but he becomes flesh. So at that moment, he is in culture. He's enculturated and he's been translated into culture. And according to Timothy Keller, that's one of what makes Christianity so unique. We can be translated into any language or culture. See, if you want to be a Buddhist, you've actually got to become Asian. If you want to become a Muslim, you've actually got to become Middle Eastern. You know, the Quran technically cannot or should not be translated. You need to read it in the original Arabic. So any translated Quran is not the true Quran. But Christianity makes the opposite claim, that we can be translated into any language, any culture. And that was a claim of Pentecost. We can hear Jesus in our culture on our terms. But note, even here, we can't escape culture. So to describe the second person of the Trinity, John had to use the Word, and in Greek he used logos, and already there's culture. This is a Greek cultural word which had all these prior connotations. It was the unifying force of the universe. So even to describe the second person of the Trinity out of culture, you had to use a culture word, logos. And we're so used to this now, the Word became flesh. But think about it. If you're a missionary now translating John 1 into another language, what are you going to use for the Word? So the people who went to China, when they translated logos into Chinese, do you know what they had to use? See, this is your dilemma. You invent a word which has no prior meaning, but that's meaningless then. Or you have to find a word in their culture, but that's going to have wrong meanings in it. But that's exactly what John did when he grabbed logos. So they went, the towel became flesh. And you think, oh, can you do that? Are you allowed to do that? Because towel is Taoism. You know, that's all got, but it's the unifying force that combines, holds together the universe. So it's an accurate translation, but carries prior meaning. But now you appropriate and give it a new meaning. And maybe if that's not lost to us, that would be like if we went to a Star Trek-y nerdy convention full of geeks and Star Wars fans, and we said, the Force became flesh. You think, oh, are you allowed to do that? Well, I think that's what John has done. When he said the Logos became flesh, he actually went to a Star Wars geeky convention and said, guys, the Force became flesh. I think that's really what he's doing. Don Carson, oh yeah, I've got the quote there. So you always know when someone's struggling when they have to pull the Don Carson card out. So here, I'm pulling the Don Carson card out. Are you saying what I'm saying? No truth which human beings may articulate can ever be articulated in a culture-transcending way. We can't escape culture. But that doesn't mean the truth thus articulated does not transcend culture. So that's our tension. We're trying to say something that's true for all cultures, that transcends cultures. But to say it, we have to do it in a cultural-laden way. So the significance is this is actually the strength of Christianity. Embrace it. We are translatable into any culture. So that's it's a strength to embrace rather than to run away from. All right, let's go to the page now. What's God's view in culture? We've just looked at the Word became flesh and the incarnation. B, also theologians talk about general revelation, and this is the idea that there is some knowledge of God that is universally available. That is, God communicates universally with and through his creation. And if so, could it be that we human beings communicate back both explicitly and implicitly? If so, in all cultures can be found some form of God-human dialogue. So what I'm saying here is typically we say God talks to everyone. So you don't have to be a Christian. God is still talking to you. And typically we say he talks to us in creation. So somehow by just looking at the stars and the beauty around us, we say, you know, there is a God. So that's general revelation. People often say, even in history, God reveals himself. When you sort of look at, wow, you know, when God saved England at Dunkirk in World War II, people often say, you know, that was the hand of God. So looking at historical events, we can see God. Looking at humanity, God talks to us because somehow we have this religiousness. We have a quest for religion. Now we have a quest for morals as well. So somehow universal, we all believe in right and wrong. And you can list other things. There's joy, there's beauty, there's creativity. And that goes on and on and on. So somehow looking at human beings, we think, oh, there must be a God. Otherwise, we wouldn't be so religious. We wouldn't believe in morals. We have a joy. We have a beauty. We're very creative. And if we go with this, somehow in this, in our dialogue, in what we produce, God is actually talking to us. So even what humans produce is general revelation. So in culture and in the text that culture produces is almost the voice of God. We can hear God talking to us in what humanity produces. So that's the idea of general revelation. Let's go to C now. There's also the idea of common grace. And here the reformers in the 1600s, they identified a category called common grace, God's goodness to all peoples, God's undeserved care of all creation, all people, apart from his special grace. So special grace is where he saves us. But common grace is where he just gives us good things. Doesn't matter whether you're a Christian or not. And the reformers gave these examples. For example, he maintains the universe and gives everyone life. He sends rain. He makes crops grow. He feeds animals and people. He restrains sin. He delays judgment. And he gives us human learning and creativity, arts, sciences, philosophy, and he gives us social, political order. So God provides and maintains good things in creation. And that's why as Christians we're happy for our children to learn maths from a non-Christian maths teacher, because there's truth and goodness out there. You don't have to be a Christian to have it. Our kids can learn swimming from a non-Christian swimming teacher. There's goodness and beauty in the Christian and the non-Christian world. So Richard Mao from America, he says, typically, we see God glorified in salvation, but we also see God glorified in culture. Somehow there's a beauty in culture that glorifies him. All right, so let's go over the page. And the significance then is, that's why there's beauty in the arts. There's wisdom in the sciences, Christian and non-Christian. There's truth in other religions, and by that I mean they won't have saving truth, but, you know, there will be truth in what other people say in other religions. And there's a morality and conscience in all humans. So in this sense, all goodness is God's goodness, from Van Hooser, and we could also say all beauty is God's beauty. So analysis, if this is correct, in all cultures, we should be able to find some aspect of God's truth, God's goodness, and God's beauty in all cultures, Christian and non-Christian cultures. So that's number one. That's the God aspect of culture. Let's look at the human aspect of culture. So this is point two now. There's a legitimate human cry in culture. Human beings are always crying out legitimately, and we can hear it in culture. How can I say this? Well, A, because of the image of God. We're all created in the image of God. So one way that this works out is we share God's creativity. So we create worlds of meaning. We create texts with meaning. In other words, we create culture. So just as Adam cultivated the garden, Genesis 2. So remember, that's the mandate God gives Adam and Eve. I want you to work the garden. And interestingly, the English word for working the garden is to cultivate. And that's where we get culture. So somehow in us working on earth, we produce culture. And that's God's mandate to us. So we often talk about a creation mandate. Kevin Van Hooser likes to also talk about a cultural mandate. We've been mandated to create culture. So that's first thing, we're in the image of God, we're creating culture. And over the page I've said the same thing. Next thing, B, eternity. God has placed eternity in the hearts of all humans. So have a look at this quote from Ecclesiastes. I've seen the burden God has laid on people. He's made everything beautiful in its time, and he set eternity in our hearts, yet we can't fathom what God has done. So that means somehow to be human is we carry a burden from God, a longing for eternity, a God consciousness, a longing for wisdom and understanding, and I'm just reading this in front of you, and it's in the midst of God's beauty. So every human has this existential cry for transcendence, meaning, and eternity. And I think that's why we have this religiousness in us. And all cultures reflect this worldview in their texts. So somehow, in all cultures and in all texts, we should be able to find us producing, because of God's creativity, because we're in the image of God, and also this cry for eternity in all cultures. All right, but three, now some of us are going to say, yeah, but not all culture is good. And that's right. This brings us to three. There is sin in every culture because all humans are sinful. We're sinful from birth. All have sinned. Every aspect of us is affected by sin. As a result, in every culture, I also believe there'll be some way of expressing rebellion, idolatry, wandering, suppressing the truth, brokenness, and also the curses that we see in Genesis 3. Or as Timothy Keller puts it, because of common grace, no non-Christian culture is as bad as it should be, but because of depravity, no Christian culture is as good as it should be. So that should keep us humble. Or as I put it, so I love putting my quote under a Keller quote, as I put it, every culture will find its way of crying out to God, but every culture will also find its way of running away from God. And that's what we're trying to do, work out which bit is wit in culture. All right, so let's go to number four. There will be a redemptive analogy in every culture. So from Romans 8, it says creation groans for redemption, and the image of God in all of us should also long for redemption. And because we have this cry for eternity, somehow in every culture, there's going to be a cry for redemption. We should be able to find what's called a redemptive analogy in every culture. So C.S. Lewis, he studied stories, traditions, and myths in all these different cultures. And he says, he's found in all these stories, all these myths, all these legends, what he calls seeds of the gospel. Something that you can see God has put in there, or because of our cry for redemption, some seed of the gospel. And so, as you know, then C.S. Lewis then decides he's going to write fiction that can put these little seeds of the gospel. So he did some science fiction series, and then he did, you know, the Narnia series, showing how he can write stories where there's seeds of the gospel. His friend J.R. Tolkien sort of poo-pooed it and said, "Ah, you're so blunt." He thought, that was like sledgehammer stuff. He says, "I'll write stuff that even more subtle, you know, seeds that are even more subtle." So that's The Lord of the Rings. The seeds are there, just a little bit more subtle, less blunt than the Narnia things. Don Richardson, who you're probably familiar with. So his story is he and his wife went to the tribes of New Guinea, and they're telling the people in New Guinea the story of Jesus. They're telling the story of Jesus, story of Jesus, story of Jesus, and they get to the bit where Judas betrays Jesus, and they all cheer, yeah, because as you know, in that culture, treachery and betrayal were the highest virtues. So that moment, Judas became the hero, yeah, and in that moment, Don and his wife just went, oh, how are we ever going to tell these people the gospel? Their value systems are so mixed up. And that's when, as you know, they found out, wow, these guys have this little ritual because they're so warmongering, so much into treachery and betrayal. The only way their villages aren't going to wipe each other out is each village had to get a baby and swap it with the other village so that you wouldn't massacre that village because your child was going to be in that village. And that child became known as the peace child. And suddenly they thought, that's it, the peace child. That's our, and that's where we get the term, that's our redemptive analogy. In every culture, there's an analogy that we can latch onto that can connect us with the gospel. So over the page, you can see I've got there. So in every culture should be conceptual links between creation, which is what all cultures have, and redemption, which is where we're trying to get them to, from creation to redemption. And Jesus in the New Testament does it. So when he talks about, I am the good shepherd, he's using a redemptive analogy. He's grabbing something in their culture and using it. And Paul does it when he talks about, you know, Jesus ransoms us. He's actually grabbing something from their culture and then explaining it. Or Paul talks about the armor of God. That's something from their culture, a redemptive analogy. So the analysis then is God has somehow prepared every culture for the gospel. Every culture, no matter how lost, we should be able to find some redemptive analogy in there. So as a summary and conclusion, what I'm saying is this. Because of the incarnation, Jesus came into culture, the good news can enter any culture. So any culture we can think of, we can translate the gospel into that culture. Because of general revelation, common grace, and the image of God being in everyone, There will be truth in every culture. No matter how lost we think that culture is, there should be some truth in that culture. Because of our cry for eternity, every culture will somehow be crying out for God. And that's our job as an evangelist, to try to see, how are they crying? Where am I hearing the cry for eternity in this culture? Because of the redemptive analogy idea, every culture will have an analogy that our gospel can connect to. Because of human depravity, every culture will have some sin that our gospel will have to challenge. And all cultures by themselves are not totally good and they're not totally evil. There'll be something that the gospel will find in common, and there'll be something that the gospel will need to challenge. I think that's over the page there. All right, so I've got time for questions, maybe 10 minutes of questions.
Dan,
yes.
What would you say in our culture, the real zinger of a redemptive analogy would be?
All right. Oh, we could do that. The whole problem is that's coming in the next part and the next part, but it would be good to start thinking about what are redemptive analogies in our culture. Yeah, Paul?
Oh, no, sorry, I was just adjusting my hair.
Okay, sure. Yeah, no worries. Yes? All right, so before I can communicate the gospel, like how much do I have to know of their culture? Is that what you're saying? Well, we'll never have total 100% knowledge of any culture. So in that sense, we don't need 100% perfect knowledge. So that's asking too much of ourselves. But at the same time, we have to know a little bit about them, but it doesn't have to be perfect 100%. So if we're happy to have a go, we're happy to have a go. So I want this to empower us rather than get us, oh, now I can never reach out to this culture. But it just means, well, it's to give us hope that any culture, no matter how lost, I should be able to find something there I can connect the gospel to. And maybe that's my job now, just to see where if I can hear, understand, and feel this culture. So it's about being a good listener, which we all are. Yeah. Yes.
Adjusted what you would say to that group as opposed to another?
Oh, okay, yeah. So I was sharing yesterday. I'm realizing there's probably no one here from yesterday except one, so I can just go for it. Several. I'll just share. Oh, what have I adjusted in the city? Yeah, okay. So typically we've always gone, this is how I've adjusted. And we've gone for, this is something true, you need to believe it. This is something, because it's true, you need to believe. And because you believe it, this is now how you have to live. But I'm seeing more and more people in the city are just trying to survive. They're trying to survive. And so I'm going to show, hey, this is something livable. Because it's livable, it's believable, and because it's believable, it's actually true. So we're beginning, being much more at the creation level, trying to get them to salvation, rather than trying to preach salvation at the start, maybe that's what I'm trying to say, rather than say, hey, you're lost, you're sinful, you need forgiveness, you need eternal life, because right now you're going to go to hell, I'm starting to show, hey, you're looking for these things. So I'm worshiping much more on the existential cry. And in the city, what they're looking for is security, because there's no job security. And to be a good leader, I need to be secure. So that's a big one. And they're just trying to look to survive. So they're at a very much of a survival mode. And purpose. After a while, you think, is this really what I want to do for the rest of my life? And so I'm trying to show, you're looking for security, you're looking to survive, you're looking for purpose. They're good questions. So that's your existential cry. Let me show you how by having Jesus, you'll actually have security. He'll give you rest. He'll give you direction. This is more believable. Actually, he's true. So I think that's how I've modified it. Whereas maybe 10 or 15 years ago, if I did youth group talks to church kids who'd been to Sunday school with a Bible knowledge, it was much more, you could just come straight in. You know, here's a Bible verse, and it says you're lost, you're going to die, you're going to go to hell, repent, and people do. I think it's much more you got to start at this end. Yeah. Yes.
Sorry, so following that, how do you stay away from the kind of looking, like in some ways you can almost slide into God, the kind of, there's a God-shaped hole in your heart, you're looking for security, Jesus, like, how do you kind of keep the gospel center and not kind of,
So it was back to those original questions of what is the definition of contextualization. It's saying that these are the questions you're asking. I'm not going to give you the answers you want to hear. I'm going to give you God's answers to the questions you're asking. So what's happening is you're hearing their needs, but then you say, your needs actually represent something else. They're coming from an existential, God-given existential cry. And that's coming because there's a God. That's what you're showing. So you're coming here and you're taking them back this way. Yeah, that makes sense. So first of all, hey, your needs are good needs because they're actually coming from a legitimate God-given cry. But guess what? Because they're a God-given cry, they're actually given to you so that you go to God, not go elsewhere. Very much the woman of the well, hey, you've come for water, that's your need. But actually, you're thirsting for something deeper than that, you know, a meaningful relationship that will last, you know, eternal water, living water. You're actually after a God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, Paul.
I had a question with the common general relation category.
Yes.
Every bit of culture is good. So, I guess this might be more of a clarification.
Yeah.
So pornography, you know, there's some art which is criticized for being pornography.
Yeah.
And I guess the existential cry is beauty and connection and security or relationship. And God really knows how to fulfill that. He's the one who made us beautiful, made us male and female. So it's not like everything just because it's in a museum or at a news agency is an expression of culture that glorifies God.
Yep.
But it all is coming out of something that's a mixture of good and bad, which is us. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, so there is a nuance. So general revelation is quite tricky because let's say we use the creation category. You know, look at the sun, look at a human hand, look at a human eye. There's design, there's purpose. That's wonderful. So that's what they call teleology. Look at the design, the purpose. There must be a designer. And of course, the counter argument, as you know, is there's dis-teleology. You know, like there are hurricanes, there are earthquakes. You know, there's tsunamis. You know, what sort of designer does this? So where you see design, I see chaos. Why do you say the universe is like a watch? Hume would say the universe is like a rotting piece of vegetable. You know, that's more... I don't see design in a rotting bit of vegetable or garbage. Why are you choosing the watch? I choose a rotting cabbage as my analogy for the universe. And so there's always a both and going on in general revelation just because of the Genesis 3 curse, I think. And so then when I'm talking about human creativity, you're going to get the same thing going on, a bit of teleology and dis-teleology because of the Genesis 3 curse. All right, we'll break now.